The Book of Romans, the Apostle Paul's longest letter, is thought of to be the most important and certainly most influential of his writings. Within it, Paul lays out in great detail what everyone's shared problem is and what God has provided in and through and by Jesus as a solution to it.
I too want to welcome you to Westside. It's good to have you here. My name is Norm, and I'm inviting you to turn in your Bibles to Romans chapter 3. We are looking at verses 9 to 20, and in that, finishing off section number 1, which we've called the problem. We finished that off today. We will go into a Christmas series for the month of December, culminating on December 24th, where we are gathering down at the Weston Bayshore for our Christmas Eve gathering. We'll give you more information about that starting next week. And then in January, we begin section number 2, God's provisions. We'll pick things up in verse 21 of chapter 3, and we'll carry on through chapter 5, and we'll go from there. So we're in Romans chapter 3, verses 9 to 20, big Sunday. Chad will give you some information on the back end about a baptism is taking place both here at Kitts Beach and also on the North Shore at Ambleside. There's a North Shore member who's getting baptized there as well. So exciting. We're going to show a video on the back end. Again, you'll get more information about that from Chad on the back end on where to go. So if you're a guest and you're here for a baptism of a friend or a family member, great to have you. Thank you for being here. Let's pray together and we'll start walking through these great verses together. Father, I thank you for the things that have taken place thus far this morning. I thank you that we get to celebrate together, especially in regards to baptism, as we observe those that are getting baptized as a declaration to the world that they are followers of Jesus, and this is what Jesus has done for me, and this is who I am in Jesus. And so I thank you. I thank you for the beauty of the day. The sunshine, I know it's a little cool, but what a beautiful day. So thank you that we get to gather outside in this beautiful city and we get to celebrate and declare to this city that you are indeed real and working and moving. And Father, I pray that you would help us now to be good listeners, not to me, but to be good listeners to you as your spirit works through your word. We all can talk well. We can all argue and we can all disagree. Help us to be a good listener. Help all of us. Use me as a conduit, nothing more, nothing less of your words to us today so that we would have that type of reception that would lead to places where you want us to go and places where you want us to go from. We pray for all of these things in Jesus' great name. Amen. Just to give you a little bit of a review, especially for those of you that are guests or haven't been around for a while. As I said, we're finishing off the book of Romans, the first section of it, what we've called the problem. Over the last couple of months, we've journeyed with Paul, and he has argued a couple of things in regards to the gospel, the good news story of Jesus. One of the things that he's argued for is the wonder of it. He talks about its power, talks about how it's for everyone, which ties into the second thing that he's argued for, and that is the necessity of it. It's wonderful, it's for everyone, but it's also necessary for all people. And that's essentially what Paul has argued for and done over these last three chapters. In chapter 1, he displayed and showed and argued that those individuals that he calls the Greeks or the Gentiles, synonymous terms, because the Greek culture was all-encompassing. So if you weren't a staunch observer of Judaism and Orthodox in your faith, you were regarded as a Greek or a Gentile. You were Hellenized. You were Greek cultured. So synonymous terms. And he argued in chapter 1 that even if you didn't call yourself a follower of God, you're still guilty before God because God has revealed himself to you in a variety of ways, either through the things around you that have been created or even on your own hearts. That's a revelation of God's working in your life, but we have all exchanged that glory and revelation for other things and turned to other things. And therefore, those that are Gentiles and Greeks, you're guilty before God. That's your problem. That's the problem in your life. But in chapter 2, and I'm pointing at the screen, that's what I'm doing. In chapter 2, he then turns his attention to his Jewish brethren, arguing that they are in the same place, perhaps arriving a little bit differently, but in the same place of the Gentiles, that they too stand guilty before God, not because they out and out rejected God with their lips and said, we don't follow God, but instead their guilt comes because they didn't place their faith and trust in God, but on other things. And that's what chapter 2 is about. Paul highlights a couple of those things that they had rested their faith and dependence upon. He pointed out that having the very oracles of God, the very word of God, the promises of God was not good enough, was not enough assurance to them, assuring them of a saving eternal relationship with God. He pointed out the fact that in spite of God having chosen the nation out of all other nations, the Israelites, the Jewish nation, to be a special people, did not in and of itself guarantee that every Jew individually was going to experience the blessing of God. And finally, he pointed out that just because of circumcision specifically, that sign, that symbol, that sign of the covenant doesn't necessarily mean that you know and are joining the blessings of that covenant. Same thing with baptism. Baptism is a great symbol of a relationship with Jesus. It's a symbol of what Jesus has done for us. He died. He rose from the grave. We have died with Jesus. We too have raised to newness of life. It's a great symbol, but it's just the symbol. It doesn't guarantee our salvation. And that's what the Israelites were doing too with the sign of circumcision. It was a sign of the covenant, but it didn't guarantee one that they were in the covenant relationship with God. Last week was Pushback Sunday, if you remember chapter 3, verses 1 to 8. Paul's made this big, long argument in chapter 2, and if you were a Jewish reader, you would have some questions in response. Some, but what about this, Paul? And what about this, Paul? And that was last week, verses 1 to 8. Some of the questions that were a part of their pushback. Paul, if what you're saying is true, then what advantage is it to even having the signs of the covenant, for example? Paul's response, there's a tremendous advantage as long as those signs are coupled with faith. They had questions like, if so many of God's people in Israel have rejected the Messiah and fallen away, doesn't that call into question God's faithfulness? I mean, if God has called a bunch of people to be faithful and they all screw up, then maybe God's got a problem. Maybe he's got an issue. Paul's response, by no means, because God can be faithful in two ways to us. He can be faithful to bless as we grab onto his promises, and he can be faithful to judge. God is faithful. He's faithful to himself. It's a question of whether we will know his faithfulness and blessing or judgment. That was Paul's response. God's not unfaithful. He's entirely faithful. It led to questions like, well, if God's justice is magnified through the wickedness of humans, remember this? Is it really right then for God to go and pour out his judgment on people who are doing things that are already magnifying God's righteousness and his greatness and his faithfulness? I use the illustration of that black fabric. If my life is black fabric and God is the jewel and I make the jewel look really great by my blackness, then man, he shouldn't come down on me. Paul's response, in a sense, was God doesn't need your black fabric to pop. He doesn't need your black fabric to look good. God's good enough in himself to pop, to shine bright. He doesn't need us to help him in that. And then finally, one of the questions that comes out at the end of that text from last week is, well, Paul, if our lying and our unfaithfulness, if our unbelief highlights God's truthfulness, why should we be condemned? And then they ask the question, why not do evil so that good can come? Paul's response to this is almost dismissive. He says, in a sense, the very statement, why not do evil that good may come, is self-condemning. And in other words, the very question in itself really highlights who you are. He uses the expression, you're talking like a mere man. You're talking like a natural man. You're not thinking supernaturally. You're not considering things spiritually. The question itself really says something about you, is his answer at that point, after presuming many other questions. So that takes us up to this week. And like I said, we end section one today. How does Paul end it? How does Paul end his discussion, his lengthy discussion on just laying out the problem of all humanity. Well, let me give you kind of a layout of the verses that we're looking at today, verses 9 to 20. He begins with another question that he presumes. That's seen in the first part of verse 9. So he begins with another question. And then in the second part of verse 9, he gives his answer. And then what he does from verses 10 through 18 is he lays out proof for his answer. He gives four proofs, four evidences, four manifestations that highlight why he believes what he believes. So question, answer, four proofs, and then he answers in verses 19 and 20 what the solution is not. Okay, not what the solution is. Verses 19 and 20 is, if this is the problem, this is our situation, here's the proof, here's what you shouldn't do. Don't do what verses 19 and 20 say to do. Do the opposite of that, in a sense. Okay, I'll make more sense of that. Sounds sacrilegious. I'll help you out with that when I go to verses 19 and 20. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to highlight, going ahead, looking ahead to January, and talking about what the answer is. So verses 19 to 20 is what the answer is not. Then we'll springboard ahead, all right? So that's where we are. So let's look first at the question. The question, as I said, is seen in the first half of verse 9. What then? What then? Are we Jews any better off? Now here's something that jumped out at me when I started studying and getting prepared for this morning. Why are they even asking this question? Why is Paul presuming that they would? Because it seems that Paul's hammered the Jews for quite a while now. Like, why would they begin verse 9 with, well, are we better off? Are we better off? Because in verses 1 to 8, he's just absolutely gone through and goes, this is why you're not, this is why you're not, this is why you're not. So why does he do it here? I'll give you two reasons. Two reasons that I think perhaps are why. One is, I think Paul really loves his brothers. He loves his brethren. He loves his Jewish family. And I think because of Paul's missionary endeavors, he knows that there's probably still a remnant, in spite of what he's talked about in chapter 2 all the way through verse 8 of chapter 3, that may still wonder, is there any exception at all? I mean, any. Is anybody cut from a different cloth? That there's always one or two in the group, right? Okay, if I hear you correctly, I think you're saying this, but is there any exception? So I think perhaps through his missionary journeys, he's encountered individuals that still, maybe at this point, still aren't convinced. Secondly, and I think more significantly, what Paul is going to do in verses 10 to 18 is he's going to backtrack and go through their story within the scriptures. You probably can see that in your text. Everything from verse 10 through 18 are just direct quotes from a variety of places within the Old Testament, what we call the Old Testament. And what he's going to do is he's going to take his argument and he's going to share from their own story why they have an issue and what their problem is. So he asks the question one more time. Paul, is there any exception, to put it in the words that Paul is? What then, are we Jews better off? And here's the answer. So that's the question. The answer is in the second part of verse 9. No, not at all. For we have already charged that all, both Jews and Greeks, are under sin. You need to know there's a lot of debate about who that we is in verse 9. That question that they ask, are we Jews better off than they? You probably note, if you use the ESV, the Bible that we use, that there's a number, probably a reference by that word Jews. And then if you go look in your footnote somewhere, the margin of your Bible, the bottom of your Bible, it says, are we without Jews? Meaning that in the transcripts that the people used to put together this translation, that word Jews is not in the original transcripts. They've added it. Now, they're not trying to be secretive. What they're trying to do is look at things in context, and they are adding it for us as a reader so it makes sense to us. But here's the thing. I don't think it should have been, if I could be so bold. If you use the NIV, it doesn't add it. The NIV doesn't have the word Jews in there. But it's added in the ESV. And again, they're not trying to deceive us. That's why they have the footnotes in the text for us. The question is, who is Paul talking about? Is Paul talking about we Jews, speaking about those of Jewish lineage, are we better off than the Gentiles? That's how the ESV answers it for us. Are we better off than the Gentiles? We Jews, meaning the Jewish nation, the Jewish people. Or is Paul saying here, asking here, speaking as a Christian? Are we Jewish Christians better off than they? What do I think, for what it's worth? I don't think it matters, quite honestly. I just don't think it matters. I think you can write a lot of books on it. You can. There have been. Lots of stuff written about it. I just don't think it matters. The reason why I don't think it matters is because Paul's main point is seen in the second part of the phrase. So regardless of how you answer the first part, his main part is the second part of verse 9. When he says, we have all charged that both Jews and Greeks, whether we're talking about the nation or whether they're talking about Jewish Christians, we are all under sin, no exceptions. Male and female, Jew and Greek, slave and free, we are all under sin. I think that's Paul's point. What does it mean to be under sin? Paul doesn't say we're sinners. He says we're under sin. What does it mean to be under sin? Let me give you three things it means. One is, it means that we're under the guilt of sin. But we're not under the subjective guilt of sin. We're under the objective guilt of sin. What do I mean by that? Well, most of the time when we talk about guilt of sin, we think about sin subjectively. In other words, I feel guilty because of something I've done. But that's not how Paul is talking about it. How Paul is talking about it, and the reason why he's not talking about it that way, is because if you ever met somebody who is involved in certain things, certain practices, and says, I feel no guilt about it, or you've met somebody who still feels guilty about something they did, even though they've been forgiven of it. In other words, subjective feelings about sin is not a good barometer on whether we are guilty of sin or not. We hear that quite a bit, quite often. And what Paul is saying is, objectively, we are under the guilt of sin. Every single one of us, whether we feel it or not, is guilty of sin. So what is it to be under sin? It's under the guilt of sin. But in addition to that, it also means that we are under the penalty of sin. Here's what you need to know about God and God's holiness in regards to sin. God's holiness, God is holy, God is righteous, God is just. God's holiness must punish sin. There is a penalty to sin. There's a ransom to sin. There's a record of debt to sin. And God's holiness must punish sin. Now, what is that flowing out of the holiness of God that punishes sin? It's a word that we've seen all the way through these first three chapters. Wrath. Now, here's what you need to know about God's wrath. I don't know why I'm clapping. Here's what you need to know about God's wrath. God is not wrath like God is love. In other words, if you remove sin, there will be no wrath of God. So when we're in heaven, there will be no wrath of God, but there will be love and there will be holiness. But what wrath is, it's the effect or the outpouring of God's holiness. Because God is holy, God must bring judgment down on sin because he's holy and just and right. Now, God, like I've talked about in regards to his wrath, is not God running around, you know, flailing. God, it's God's judgment because of God's holiness. But, and here's the great news. The great news story is you remove sin. When that record of debt that Paul writes about in Colossians chapter 3 is nailed to the cross, that record of debt is gone. God's wrath removed off your life. It's removed. You are not under the wrath of God. But if we're under sin, God's wrath, because he's holy, is still on us. Because he's holy. So that's the second thing that we need to know about being under sin. So there's the penalty of sin, there's the guilt of sin, and then thirdly, there's the power of sin. What's the power of sin? Well, to put it in basic form, it means that we no longer have any ability to do anything that would bring honor and glory to God until we deal with our sin. It's being in bondage and enslavement. It's evidenced in our life in an inability to see the good things that God offers, evidence in our lack of thankfulness to God. It also is evidence in that we don't desire the good things that God made us for, evidence in our desire to go our own way. In fact, we're handcuffed to do so. We're like the animal that gets caught in a cage. You ever seen this either on TV or maybe you've seen it live? Animals caught in the cage and some sort of animal caregiver wants to set the animal free. Yet the animal is freaked out of being set free because the animal thinks that the caregiver is going to do something worse to it. And so what does it do? Just freaks out in the cage. Right, gets angry, freaks out, you know, growls, bites, whatever, in the cage, and it stays in the cage, has a tough time getting out of the cage, even though the caregiver is going, look at what I have for you. Yet the animal is just absolutely convinced that it's better in the cage. That's what it's like being under the power of sin. We're not convinced that God has our best in mind, and so we stay in our cages going, no, this is better. What would he have me do? That's not going to be better. He just wants to destroy my life, suck all life out of my life. That's what it's like being under the power of sin. So that's what it's to be under sin. It's to be under the guilt, under the penalty, under the power of sin. It's bondage. It's slavery. This is the way we are, Paul says in verse 9. All of us outside of Christ is under sin. And therefore, the idea that we could do some thing that would bring us back to reconciliation with God is ridiculous if we are the problem. Like, if that's us, why would we ever think that we could solve it? It's ridiculous, is Paul's argument. So that's the question, okay? That's the question. Any exceptions, Paul? That's the answer. No, not at all. We're all under sin. Now, Paul, like I've talked about lots, he just presumes pushback. And what he does now is he's made this overarching statement. We're under sin, but now he's going to prove it. And he's going to prove it by highlighting four things that manifest in our lives when we're under sin. Now, here's where I need some of you to just join me. Some of you are hearing that and going, well, this doesn't apply to me, man, because, you know, I'm convinced of what Paul has said previously. I know I need Jesus. I know I have a sin problem. I've given my life to Jesus. So these four manifestations have nothing to do with me. Oh, Westside. How wrong you are, right? We've talked about the need for gospel truth, gospel proclamation in our lives throughout these three chapters as well. We need the gospel as much as non-believers need the gospel because we all have a tendency to want to go back to Egypt. You know what I mean? Like the story of Egypt and the Israelites in bondage and slavery to a tyrannical ruler named Pharaoh. Our tyrannical rulers, he's Satan. Set free. How? Passover. Right? The lamb, blood shed, right? Freedom. Freedom how? Through baptism, the water, right? We're doing baptism this afternoon. It's going to be awesome. Baptism through water. Then they go into the wilderness. This journey in the wilderness to do what? Worship. Worship. But in this journey are these times where they go, boy, Egypt was great. So great there. Oh man, that's awesome. We should go back to Egypt, right? Just like that old Keith Green song. Anybody know? I mean, the three of us that listened to Keith Green in the 80s, remember that? Thank you, man. I see one or two hands. Thank you very much. So, I mean, just, I want to go back to Egypt. It was so better in Egypt, man. Have the manna bread, right? And manna cotti, right? Remember that song? Right? Go back to Egypt, man. It'd be great. It's going to be great. That's our tendency. But to be serious with you, to be very straightforward with you, we have an enemy that wants to take us back. And so when we go through these manifestations, what I want all of us to see is, or ask of ourselves is any of this showing up? Even though I'm a follower of Jesus, these four things, does any of it show up in my life now? So what are they? If we're under sin, what are these four things that manifest in our lives? The first is, and you can see it in verses 10 to 12, our condition shows up in our heart disposition. Let me read verses 10 to 12. As it is written, none is righteous. No, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. Now, what's Paul doing here? Why does he begin this way? Well, Paul knows that he's speaking primarily to a religious group of people. He's not just speaking to Roman Christians. He's speaking to the Jewish community. And therefore, I believe if he began with giving examples that they were all under sin, like the examples that he gives to the Gentile group back in chapter 1, I think what they would have done is they would have responded as we do. And that is, they would have looked at a list of things and gone, I've never done that. I've never murdered. I've never shed blood. I didn't do any, have never done any of those things, never cheated on my spouse. I'm a good dad. I'm a good citizen. And therefore, I'm guilty of nothing. We're all prone to this. This is our reaction too. We trumpet our hatred of religion, yet get altogether religious when we defend ourselves. We point to the things we do and don't do, and we defend ourselves very religiously, although we hate religion. That's what they would have done, and I think Paul knew that. So instead, Paul speaks about things that we can all relate to. And he does it by referencing three different texts from the Old Testament in these three verses. One comes from Ecclesiastes 7, another from Psalm 14, and another from Psalm 53. And I want you to note the words that come up over and over. Did you pick them up? None, not even one, none again, all, none again, not even one again. I mean, no guessing what Paul is getting at. Paul's point is that there is no one who is righteous. Everyone comes under this. None is righteous, as you can see at the beginning of verse 10. And here's what Paul is arguing and not arguing for with this group of readers. He's not arguing about whether or not they sometimes did some quote unquote good things. He is saying they're not good enough. He is also talking about the times when we don't do good things, even though we know we should. He's saying, check your heart. Why don't you do good things if you know that they're meant to be done? Check your heart. But most of all, he is calling into question why we attempt to do good things at all. Again, he's saying, check your heart. For even good things done for your glory are not inherently good. Paul will argue later on in the book of Romans over that very issue. That comes up today. People today do many good things, usually with the adage to them being, I do them because they make me feel good. Good things done for our glory, to make us feel good. So Paul is going, I want to go after your heart. I want you to delve deep into who you are. I want you to slow down, stop the music, take some free time when nobody else is around and check your heart. Why do you do good things? Why don't you do good things? I mean, who are you? Why? Who do you live for? Why are you doing any of this? And what I want you to see and what you will see if you have this discussion with yourself is, yes, Paul, there is none who is righteous. None of us are. No, not one, none. All of us are not righteous. That's Paul's argument in this, and he begins with the heart disposition. One of the pushbacks, before we move on to the second, that you get in verses like this is, how can he say that no one seeks God? No one seeks God, no one goes after God. I mean, come on, all you got to do is look around the world, and you can see billions, literally, of people that are very religious. How can you say no one seeks God when all you got to do is turn on the TV, open the front page of your newspaper and see what people are chasing after? Well, we need to remember that one of the greatest deceivers of a God pursuit is participation in things religious. Religion and religions are full of zealousness, but coupled with ignorance and hearts far from God. Paul's going to pick up this point when we get to Romans chapter 10 and look at verses 2 and 3. And all you got to do is look at the ministry and life of Jesus as recorded in the Gospels when he goes to the most religious people of the day. I mean, the most religious people of the day and says, you do not know God. In fact, God is standing before you and you want to murder him. religion can mask a heart far from God. So Paul begins looking at the heart disposition. He's asking us to look into our hearts. There's nobody else around to oppress. Just look at your heart. But if after gazing at your heart, your conclusion is, no, I'm okay. I think I have a good heart. I think I'm a good person. I think I'm a nice guy. Paul goes on and says, this condition, our condition of being under sin, is also manifested in our speech. Take a look at verses 13 and 14. Let me read it for you. Paul goes on, their throat is an open grave. They use their tongue to deceive. The venom of asps is under their lips. Their mouth is full of curses and bitterness. So what does Paul do? Just to make sure that we know the progression, Paul starts with the heart, but now he moves to the tongue. And what he says is that speech is evidence. What comes off our lips is evidence of the condition of our heart. Our speech condemns us. Paul quotes here in the verses that I read in verses 13 and 14 from three different Psalms. Psalm 5 verse 9, Psalm 140 verse 3, and Psalm 10 verse 7, all of which have something to do with the sin of the tongue. All of which are connected to the condemnation of the people who are part of Israel who have sinned with the tongue. This is Paul saying, here's an evidence of the real condition of your heart. Scriptures speak a lot of this. How what comes out of our mouths, what comes off our tongue, again, is a manifestation of something going on inwardly. And we know this. I mean, if you're a parent, you know this. You don't have to teach your kids to lie. I hope you don't have to teach your kids to lie. We don't teach them to lie here. When we have Westside kids, there's nobody teaching them to lie. I sure hope there's nobody teaching them to lie. You just don't have to do that. Why? It's natural. It's natural. And early on, we look at our 1 or 2 year old who lies and we kind of go, well, that's kind of cute, sort of. Boy, I wonder how they picked that up. I mean, I wonder if my wife or my husband, I mean, is my uncle, my weird uncle, we all have a weird uncle, have they been teaching them? I mean, how do they know? But later on, it kind of goes to a point where, boy, my kid is kind of deceiving. And early on, we kind of laugh it off a little bit. We correct, don't tell lies. We don't tell lies. You know, we want to be honest people. But later on, we all, whether you're a parent or not, know the destructive power of the tongue. We get this much more seriously. We all know the destructive power of speech to relationships. Deception in a relationship can kill it. I mean, abusive, hurtful words or promises never fulfilled can kill relationships. How about the speech? Forgive my voice. I've got a little bit left in it. How about speech that is never spoken? The hidden secrets that are never shared, and you feel, even though you don't share, you're okay because nobody knows, it'll be my secret, even though, if truth be told, your keeping of those secrets is destroying your relationships. The destructive power of the tongue, destroying marriages, relationships, friendships along the way. And Paul's saying, you don't think you need reconciliation with God? Look at your speech a little bit. It's an evidence that there's a problem deep down inside. Westside, let me just simply ask the very obvious application question. How's your speech? What's coming out of your mouth? I mean, are you a builder up of people, or do you just find some great comfort because you lack such security, you just take great comfort in tearing other people down? Are you edifying? Are you building up? Are you speaking words of encouragement, words of admonishment, words of teaching and correction and training and loving? I mean, what's coming out of your mouth? How's your speech? What about the things you aren't sharing? Is it killing your marriage? Is it killing your relationships? Because you're carrying these secrets. And again, you think nobody knows, I'll be okay. But you know what? You snap because you just can't stand yourself. And your wife or your friend has no idea what's going on because you've never shared. All they know is they got a short-tempered individual living with them. How's your speech? What comes out of our mouth evidences what's going on in our heart. It manifests our condition. But maybe you're still not convinced. My heart's good. My mouth's good. I say nice things all the time. I'm a good person. Well, Paul goes on and says in verses 15 to 17, our condition, our inward condition of being under sin manifests itself in our actions as well. Take a look at verses 15 to 17. Their feet are swift to shed blood. In their paths are ruin and misery, and the way of peace they have not known. Now, we know where Paul's going, right? He's going from the heart, began with the heart. Here's our heart disposition. Begins there. Here's our speech. Okay, if you don't believe your heart, here, take a look at your speech. Now he's going, take a look at your deeds. Take a look at what you do. And he uses some really important language. He uses the phrase shed blood. Right, that's big, shed blood. He goes from there to there to there. The act of working out of things, the deeds that we do that flow from our hearts, our condition is manifest in our actions. Jesus affirms his progression, by the way. In Matthew 15, he does the same thing Paul is doing here when he says, what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart. And this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander. You see the progression. Verses 15 to 17, the ones I just read, come right out of Isaiah 59:7. And he's applying it to all of us. It's not that he is saying that all of us shed blood or commit murder, literally. Paul knows that not everybody commits murder. Most people don't. What he is saying is that our hearts manifest a very real disinterest in real peace and reconciliation. And how that gets lived out in your life and my life may look different, but it still manifests itself. I mean, just think about it. There are some in here, I would think, in this room who can recognize in their own experience that they lack a way of peace. As Paul talks about in verse 17, the way of peace they have not known. There are some of us, I would think, in this room that have serious cracks in relationships. Cracks, perhaps, that they are a major contributor to. And in some of those relationships, what's taken place has become so strong and so emotional, the crack's so big that we stop trying to heal it. And there's no way of peace in a relationship in our life, and we have no desire to try to make a way of peace. So we just kind of go on in our lives with fractured relationships, not doing anything anymore to try to heal that relationship. And what Paul is saying is that when that happens, we are seeing an indication of what the heart is capable of. It may manifest in your life differently than someone else. Someone else may shed blood, but perhaps you just go to the other side of the room. Maybe move churches. Maybe get out of the marriage. Just stop answering calls. And we shed blood. And we lack peace. And it shows something about our hearts, is what Paul is arguing for here. That's why one of the greatest evidences of a heart that has been transformed by Jesus, as Jesus talks about, as Peter talks about, as Paul talks about, as John talks about, is that a heart that's been changed where the love of God is poured out into our hearts, as he talks about in Romans 5, is living in unity and harmony and in peace and reconciliation with others. They'll know you're my disciples by your love for one another. If you're going to the altar to give a gift at the altar and you know your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar and go make things right with your brother. Then come back and worship. If you say you love God but you hate your brother, the love of God is not in you. In fact, you don't love God at all. You hate God because the love of God has been poured out in your hearts. That if you have a heart that's no longer under sin, that's been turn from a heart of stone into a heart of flesh, is the kind of heart that goes, I'll forgive 70 times 7 times. Westside, are you living in peace with others? Reconciliation, harmony, forgiveness. And I know it's hard. I know it's hard. And you know when it's hardest? That's not a fair statement. Forgive me for saying that. You know when it's at times gets harder? When the hurt comes by way of another Christian to us, doesn't it? I'm speaking at a conference this week, later on the week, and my topic is managing conflict. I don't know why I got that topic, but I've spent some time just thinking about in preparation for that topic this week. And yeah, 10 years ago, I probably couldn't have spoken into this topic other than, you know, just from a very heady place. But over these last 10 years, I get it a little deeper now. Not to the same level that many of you have, but I get it deeper now. And as I reflect on my life, my greatest pain have come from other Christians. But I got to forgive 70 times, 7 times. And live in peace and harmony. And pray for those who persecute me in the same way that you have the same call. Because we have an enemy that wants to take us back to Egypt. And it's easy to go back to Egypt. But maybe you're not convinced. Heart's good. Tongue's good. And you love people. You live with people. You have no enemies. Everybody's your friend. Paul concludes lastly then by stating that our inner condition, being under sin, manifests in our irreverence. Take a look at verse 18, short verse, lot packed in it. He goes on to say here, there is no fear of God before their eyes. The Old Testament teaches much on the fear of God. One of the more well-known statements regarding the fear of God in the Old Testament is the beginning of wisdom. Or the beginning of the knowledge or wisdom of God begins with a fear of God. There is no wisdom, no knowledge of God apart from the fear of God. Now, here's a question. What in heaven's name is it to fear God? What does it mean to fear God? It gets talked about a lot, but what does it mean to fear God? Let me give you some ideas. To fear God is to have God as your supreme goal. To have God as your highest end, your greatest pursuit, the conscious focus of your experience, the one you care about more than anyone else in the world, that his approval to be the approval that you really want, that his will to be the will done that you really want to have done. To have him at the very center of your thoughts, the center of your actions, the center of your desires. It's a healthy and reverent disposition towards God that shows up in all you do. Now, why does it say the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom? Because if you go into your marriage, into your dating relationships, into your money, into your vocation, in how you recreate and how you retire, and your desire is that God is revered in all of those things, you'll make wise decisions. But when you say things like, my time is my time, my money, my job, my kids, my retirement, my recreation, doggone it, you'll make bad decisions. But when you want to revere God and God says, I want to give you a life full and abundant, I want to set you free from that cage, you make wise decisions. That in part is what it means to fear God. Our need for grace shows up in our irreverence. Regarding the religious of Jesus' day, it says this in John 12, 42 and 43. Many even of the authorities believed in Jesus, but for the fear of the Pharisees, there's the antithesis, they did not confess it. so that they would not be put out of the synagogue. They'd hate to lose the membership. If we follow Jesus to that point, may lose my job, may lose my membership, may lose a little of my free time, may lose a relationship. They're fearful of Pharisees. They didn't want to confess it, so they would not be put out of the synagogue. For they love the glory that comes from man more than the glory that comes from God. Westside, what do you fear most? Whose glory do you crave most? Whose opinion means most? Whose approval is most desired? Peter feared a little girl around a fire more than he feared his Messiah. We do the same. So that's the, we got to wrap up. That's the question. Any exceptions, Paul? That's the answer. No, not at all. Because we're under sin. What do you mean we're under sin? How are we under sin? Well, check your heart. Heart's good. Check your speech. Speech is good. Check your deeds. Deeds are good. Okay, let me end with this. Who do you live for? Can't fake that one. Whose glory do you seek most? Can't fake it. So what's the solution, Paul? If that's who I am, if that's me, if that's my heart disposition, if I'm under sin, what's the remedy? What's the solution? Paul ends by telling us what it's not in verses 19 and 20. Now, we know that whatever the law says, it speaks to those who are under the law so that every mouth may be stopped. That's a really important phrase. And the whole world may be accountable to God. For by works of the law, no human being will be justified in his sight, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. You could do a whole sermon on those two verses, believe me. Here's essentially what Paul says. Here's the problem. Here's the problem for everybody. And you're not going to be able to remedy it by working harder. Making a list of do's and don'ts to follow. In context, taking the works of the law and trying to live them out. Why? Because you can't attain them. You can't do them. You're going to fall. And if you take this list and you try to live up to them and you don't, you know what happens as you stand before God? Your mouth is shut. Now, some of us, I know, works of law, I don't want to live according to the Old Testament. Okay, then what are your lists of do's and don'ts? And are you living up to them? See, when we create a list of do's and don'ts, even if it's our own list, if we were honest with one another, our mouths would be stopped too. Remember, I know time's out. I'm going to share the story anyways real quickly. Remember that great event in John chapter 8 where the religious leaders of the day bring the woman caught in adultery and bring her before Jesus, and they go in all their piety and smugness. The law of Moses says, Jesus. Thanks, guys. The law of Moses says, Jesus, that if a woman's caught in adultery, we should stone her. What do you say? Very famous response. To those of you who have never sinned, you go ahead and cast the first stone. And then you know what Jesus does? He starts drawing in the dirt. What? You ever wonder what he's drawn? You ever wonder what he's drawn? Here's a guess. When's the only other time God took his finger and started writing something? It's the tablets given to Moses. The very finger of God writing down the law of God. And you know what I think took place, West Side, at that moment? God took his finger and he started writing down the law. And you know what happened to the scribes and the Pharisees? Their mouths were shut. You who bring this woman before me, do you lie? Do you steal? Do you covet? Do you have other gods? Their mouths were shut. And one by one, from oldest to youngest, they walked away. And Jesus gets up, right? Takes the hair out of his face because we know he had long hair. And he says to the lady, where are they? Hey, look at that. They're not here. Where are they? Did they not condemn you? No. Then I condemn you not either. Go and leave your life of sin. See, Westside, that's what the law does. It shuts our mouth because we can't attain it. That's not the solution. It's not to work hard and try to be a better citizen. So what is the solution? What is the remedy? That's January. You got to come back in January. But let me give you a hint. Let me give you a hint. Just read a couple verses forward and then we'll shut our time down. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law. Although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. That's the remedy. Jesus. That's the greatest but in all of scriptures. Starting in verse 21. But. So great. The remedy is Jesus. So how do we end a message like this? No better way than how we're going to end it today by showing a video of stories of individuals at Westside who have come to a place where they recognize their problem and they've, by faith, come to Jesus. And they've received his work in their place because they couldn't do it. And they're going to share their stories. And later on in about an hour or so, hour and a half, we're going to baptize them in the Pacific and we're going to chip through the ice. It's going to be great. And we're going to baptize them, right? We're going to baptize them, rush them to emergency and try to get them out of hypothermia, and then we're going to rejoice with them. But we're going to hear their stories because they're going to tell a story of what Paul has just shared here. They've come to Jesus. Jesus is a remedy. They can't do it. They recognize that, and they've given their lives to Jesus. So this is what we're going to do. Run the video, and then when the band comes up, we're going to go into time of worship.